In turning to the development of bioethics and of medicine in general during the 20th century, we must begin with the pseudoscience, the dangerous and destructive myth of eugenics, a pernicious idea that refuses to die even when it's socially discredited, as happens every few decades. It is the result of the conflation of a number of things, of very legitimate advances in the science of genetics, on the one hand, and rather twisted philosophical ideas based to a limited extent in the notions of Friedrich Nietzsche and his idea of the Übermensch, or superhuman, which could evolve once one cast off the constraints of traditional morality, and a number of other factors which we'll look at. I should mention that we will be considering the subject of eugenics and the Catholic Church's response to it in more detail in a later section of this course, so we will be looking here only rather briefly and superficially at some of the most significant figures and features of this problematic idea. We begin in number 1.1 with Abbot Gregor Mendel, an Augustinian friar who was a superior eventually of a community in what is now the Czech Republic, who was himself a scientist and was fascinated with a number of areas of scientific development, but he's remembered most for his contributions to the science of genetics. And in some ways, he's regarded as the father of modern genetics. He did experiments with garden peas that demonstrated the notion of dominant and recessive inheritance of characteristics, which we would now describe as autosomal, or in the case of higher animals, sex-linked characteristics. His way of approaching these matters and his findings later proved to be of great value in establishing the science of genetics on a firm foundation, although it must be said that his ideas were not much appreciated in his own day. He published his works, and they were noted, they were copied and commented on, but the idea or the development of genetics didn't really happen until the end of the 19th century, rather than in the 1850s when he was making his biggest contributions. And I've included pictures both of, not of his own diagrams, but of the inheritance patterns that he showed, a picture of himself and of his community of canons in the Czech Republic. Another important figure is Charles Darwin, who is much misunderstood. He was in no sense the monster of anti-clericalism that he is sometimes described as later by later authors as being. He was, of course, as a result of his expedition in the ship the Beagle, and as a result of his work in the Galapagos and elsewhere, the first one to describe and to put forward the idea of natural selection. That is, that there are certain characteristics that occur, we would say today, by mutation in various species, and whether or not they are regularly reproduced, whether they become a regular part of that species, depends on how advantageous they are for the survival of that species. His work was groundbreaking. His piety is a matter of some speculation. Later in life, he was something of a free thinker. Early in life, he was particularly concerned not to say things that would scandalize his very pious Anglican wife. But in any case, he was not opposed to religion to any significant extent, and certainly he was in no way supportive of the uses to which his ideas were later put by his relative Francis Galton in the development of what would become regarded as then as the science, and what we would today call the pseudoscience of eugenics. Darwin himself does say things like, and I've quoted here, that weak members of civilized society propagate their kind. He does point out that this is something that one would not allow to happen in the breeding of domestic animals, but he points out that, excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed. So he does suggest that there are problematic traits in human society that might be linked to or related to reproducing in greater numbers. But notice that he does add, yet the aid which we feel impelled to give the helpless is mainly an incidental result of the otherwise good instinct of sympathy. We must therefore bear the undoubtedly bad effects of the weak surviving and propagating their kind. So he's pointing out that there are characteristics in humankind like sympathy and compassion that make it not only morally inappropriate, but perhaps in a broader sense evolutionarily problematic for us to attempt this project of simply improving the species in the same way that we would supposedly improve breeding animals. And as we'll see and as we'll mention, therein lies the problem that the so-called science of eugenics is based upon the notion that the approach that human beings have been using in breeding animals over the last 10,000 years, indeed for the whole of the recorded history of humankind, as much as we can tell, and long before human beings began to record their history, human beings have been selectively breeding animals, but the point is that has not resulted in a better species. The most horrific and obvious example of this is Canis domesticus, the domesticated dog, ultimately derived from wolf stock, but there is no species of dog alive today that is actually genetically superior to a wolf. We have succeeded in creating more docile dogs, but not better ones, not dogs that can survive better in the wild or that are more able to use their senses appropriately. All we've done is selectively chosen traits that we like, and the tragic results are obvious for anybody who tries to raise or breed dogs, that what we've created are dogs without the genetic diversity, the biodiversity, that would allow them to be hale and hearty and to survive well. And so that has basically been the result of our selective breeding with domestic animals, and it is the fundamental problem with the idea of eugenics. Human beings don't know what would be the best characteristics to select for. They cannot themselves select for them in any way other than forbidding certain individuals to have children. And ultimately, that decreases, not increases, the positive biodiversity, which is the characteristic that allows species to advance and develop. So Darwin himself, if his writings are looked at and taken seriously, really doesn't provide a legitimate basis for what would later evolve. And if we drop down to number 1.3, that is to say what would evolve primarily as a result of the writings of Francis Galton, who was a relative, a cousin of Darwin, but Darwin specifically disapproved of Galton's views. Galton was a scientist. He did very extensive twin studies to try to determine characteristics of genetic inheritance, some of which is quite legitimate. He did mathematical studies, which are still respected. He is still regarded as a scientist whose work is of significance in the development of both genetics and an understanding of sociology. However, his ideas about eugenics are a source of great controversy and indeed of shame to many, because to be perfectly honest, Galton was a racist. He was convinced that human society would be improved if what amounted to the upper middle class of British society could become the dominant species on Earth, and if other branches of society were forbidden or constrained from reproducing. And his writings reveal this quite clearly. There's a picture of Galton, one of his statistical charts of inheritance. He was convinced that genetics was more important in all cases than environment, and especially in the area of inheritance, of intelligence. He was convinced that you could only get intelligent people if you properly bred people, and strangely enough, his encouragement was for people who looked a lot like him to breed with women whom he regarded as particularly attractive. And he did a study of the most attractive women in England, where they could be found, and one can only presume that this was going to be a part of his program for eugenic development of his particular class of society. As I said, we'll look a little more in a little more detail at some of his ideas or theories, which became extremely popular. He was one of the founding fathers of and movements behind the Eugenics Society, which included among its members and among its supporters many of the later proponents and developers of the notion of wide availability of contraception, the encouragement of widespread availability of abortion, and indeed of many prominent members of the family planning movement, both in England and in the United States. And I've given a little quote, and again, we will come back to this in a later section of the course, section that is indented, where he puts, and this is highlighted, "I cannot doubt that our democracy will ultimately refuse consent to that liberty of propagating children which is now allowed to the undesirable classes." There is no question, of course, that these notions of eugenics were taken very seriously by the Third Reich in Germany and were a part of the eugenics policies, which were already present in the Weimar Republic before the rise of National Socialism in Germany, but which were used by the Nazis for their own propaganda purposes and in promoting their own destructive and dangerous mythology of the superiority of what they described as the Aryan or Anglo-Saxon race. However, it's important for us to know as we move down to number 1.4 that it was not only among the National Socialists of Germany that the notions of eugenics were taken seriously and implemented. They were widely implemented in the United States prior to, during, and then even after World War II until it became so politically incorrect to continue sterilizing people whom individuals regarded as undesirable that the laws in many states were changed. And so I've included in 1.4 something that we will study in more detail, the horrifying statistics of forcible sterilization, initially voluntary, but then in fact, practically speaking, forcible in many states of the United States, and the rather staggering number of individuals who were sterilized as a result of this simply eugenics program in the United States. In fact, as I've noted, and this is all a quotation from an article we'll look at in a little more detail, an article from the Annals of Internal Medicine. In a number of letters, the German eugenicists expressed admiration for U.S. leadership in instituting sterilization programs. Letters were sent, for example, to Sacramento in California, congratulating the legislature for its advanced program of sterilization. The usual way these programs worked was that people who were confined to mental institutions and who were thought to be undesirable were sterilized. If one looks carefully at the statistics and at the diagnostic methodology of the time, one has to bear in mind that there was no DSM. There was no diagnostic and statistical manual that ensured that the people who were incarcerated in these institutions were, in fact, actually mentally ill. There are documented instances of people who were forcibly placed in mental institutions because they arrived in the United States, spoke a language no one could understand, and were thought by the authorities to be babbling. So it was primarily in these institutions that people were forcibly sterilized in the United States, and this continued in many places up to 1963. As we'll see, part of the reason this stopped then was, of course, because of the social movements in favor of individual autonomy, and because finally the results of the Nuremberg trials had sunk in and people realized that it was highly embarrassing for legislatures in the United States to admit that their programs really weren't all that different from what was going on in Germany during the 1930s and 40s. If we drop down to number 5, this is the last section in our brief introduction to eugenics, and that is the response of the Catholic Church. Even very secular historians who have no particular interest in defending the Church have to admit that during the eugenics crisis, when much of the Western world was embracing the notion that by selective breeding the human race could be improved, the one consistent voice that stood out was the voice of the Catholic Church, and most clearly was the voice of Pope Pius XI. And I've quoted a section from Costi Connubii, in which he says, "Some who over solicitous cause for eugenics put eugenics before aims of a higher order, and by public order wish to prevent from marrying all those whom even no naturally fit for marriage, they consider, according to the norms and conjectures of their investigation, would through hereditary transmission bring forth defective offspring." So he articulates the eugenics agenda, and then finally concludes in number 70, "Public magistrates have no direct power over the bodies of their subjects, therefore where no crime has taken place, and there is no cause present for grave punishment, they can never directly harm or tamper with the integrity of the body either for the reasons of eugenics or for any other reason. And so the Pope and bishops throughout the world were among the most strident opposers of the eugenics movement. And again, this is well documented in the histories of the period, even the histories that are written by those who have no interest in casting the Catholic Church in a positive light.